High Noon is one of the most revered movies of Hollywood's golden era, starring screen legend Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly in her first significant film role.
Well, I'm begging you, please let's go.
I can't.
Don't try to be a hero. You don't have to be a hero, not for me.
I'm not trying to be a hero. If you think I like this, you're crazy. Look, Amy, this is my town. I've got friends here. I'll swear in a bunch of special deputies, and with a posse behind me, maybe there won't even be any trouble.
You know there'll be trouble.
Then it's better to have it here.
High Noon was shot on a lean budget over just 32 days, but achieved instant box office and critical success. It won 4 Academy Awards in 1953, including a Best Actor win for Gary Cooper, and it became a cultural touchstone, often cited by politicians as a favorite film, celebrating moral fortitude. Yet what has been often overlooked is that High Noon was made during the height of the Hollywood blacklist, a time of political inquisition and personal betrayal. In the middle of the film shoot, screenwriter Carl Foreman was forced to testify before the House Committee on Un-American Activities about his former membership in the Communist Party. Refusing to name names, he was eventually blacklisted and fled the United States. His co-authored screenplay for another classic, The Bridge on the River Kwai, went uncredited in 1957. Now, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Frankel tells the story of the making of this great American Western in his book High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. And it's a pleasure to welcome Glenn Frankel to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
What brought you to want to investigate this time and look at High Noon specifically?
I'm just an old journalist. I worked at the Washington Post for 27 years. I was a foreign correspondent here and there. Then I got into academia. And rather than try to write books about foreign countries, I wanted to write books about the United States. And I did one on John Ford's great film, The Searchers. And while we were holding a little Western film festival, a professor at the University of Texas, where I was, gave a talk about High Noon, and it was so fascinating because, as you just suggested in the introduction, you know, it combines this wonderful movie, very small movie that out of nowhere became this touchstone. I mean, we're still talking about it 65 years later. And at the same time, in such a turbulent political era in America, and even I could see when I started looking at it that there were plenty of parallels even back in 2013 to our own situation, and I'm afraid those parallels have only become clearer. So for me, you know, as I say, an old journalist, political journalist, foreign correspondent, this was the perfect combination. And it was really hard to do at times, or really challenging, but I really loved it, and I'm just so happy. I feel really lucky that I had the subject.
At what point in the process did you become focused on Carl Foreman and realizing he was really the key to the story?
Well, I knew early on, you know, that Foreman had adapted bits and pieces of his screenplay to reflect what was going on with the blacklist and the Red Scare. He'd started working on this thing 3 years earlier, had a whole different concept. But over time, it became clear to him that he himself was going to be subpoenaed, and that when you got before that committee, it wasn't going to be enough just to say, I'm not a communist anymore and I regret it. You were going to have to, for example, name names of friends of yours, of other folks who you could accuse of being a communist. And that was going to, Foreman knew that was going to be very difficult for him. He didn't want to do it. And as he's mulling this over, he can't help but notice that some of his friends and his business partners are peeling away from him. They're worried about what he's going to say. And they're worried that if he doesn't cooperate with the committee, they may be tarnished by their relationship with him. So that just became, having someone in the midst of that kind of crisis, an artist who, meanwhile, is trying to make this great movie, to me, that's irresistible. You can imagine having a character like that. And I was very lucky. I found out early on also that Foreman, you know, he was a writer. I mean, he wanted to write his own autobiography, but once he finally got back to Hollywood, he was too busy working, and then he got sick and died relatively quickly. But I was lucky to find out that he'd done a series of what I would call oral histories where he talked about his life to a friend who was also a writer. And those things were sitting out there. The family had them. There were a number of them at the British Film Institute because Forman lived a number of years in London. But there was a big collection in L.A. that a friend had. So that just opened up his whole internal life and his struggle and the deepest part of struggling to know what to do and what it was like to be blacklisted. It really opened the doors for me, and Carl therefore became my major character.
Looking at how the film and the script ultimately changed from that first draft to the final product, we should note that this was based on The Tin Star by John Cunningham. So looking at the source material and looking at the end product, talk a little bit about that transformation over time.
Well, The Tin Star and High Noon are both about a lawman who's facing a gang of killers who's coming to town. But the themes and the meaning of it changed dramatically. The Tin Star is a short story, as you say, in Collier's Magazine in 1947. It's very good. But the real theme there is a generational turnover. The marshal has two deputies, and one isn't reliable, but the other is. And the younger deputy, they're all kind of fed up with being lawmen in this situation, but the younger deputy stands by him, and the older marshal passes the baton, if you will, or passes the torch, and that's what the story's about. Well, that's not what High Noon is about. High Noon is really, the theme is one man alone who can't get his friends and allies, the people he's relied on and thought he could trust all these years, can't get them to stand by him when the bad guys come to town. He goes from house to house. He goes to the saloon. He even goes to the church at Sunday morning. And if he's going to find upright moral people and his friends, it's going to be at that church. But even they let him down. And so it's a much more pessimistic, if you will, and even bitter kind of conclusion you have to draw from that. And so Carl took the source material and really changed it. He took some of the names and some of the concepts of it, but he really fitted it to make a great movie. But it's fascinating. I recommend the short story to everyone. I mean, anyone interested in High Noon ought to read The Tin Star, because that's where the whole thing begins.
Let's talk a little bit about the making of the film and how it was impacted by Carl Forman having to go before this committee. Ultimately, Stanley Kramer, who was the producer of the film, had to fire Forman, and they were friends, right? They had a close relationship.
They definitely did. These are two young guys. They serve in World War. They meet during World War II, and they're both in the Army Corps that is making films. Documentary films and other things, and they like each other a lot. They're both liberals and progressives. They agree on politics. They also agree that the studio system, is kind of falling apart, and it's not making the kind of socially useful, dramatic movies that they want to see. So after the war, Stanley forms his own little independent film company. We'd call them, an agile, nimble little entrepreneurial outfit today. But that's kind of what they were. And of course, Carl was the first person he offered to include in, and Carl became a business partner. And they made these low budget, black and white films. First big hit was Champion with Kirk Douglas, a boxing movie. They made a number of great films. High Noon was the last of these to come up in the original company, because right around that time, Stanley signed a big production deal with Columbia Pictures. And they owed the old company one more film. So he handed that over to Carl, basically, and to director Fred Zinnemann, sent him out to do that while he and the other folks started worrying about the fact they were going to have to make 30 films over the next 5 years. But the blacklist does damage everywhere. Joe, it really hurt people. And the worst, I would say the worst damage was not with the enemies on the committee. You knew they were out to get you, and you didn't share anything with them. It was among friends and business partners and even family members, because this was about betrayal and trust and who was going to name you and what did it mean to get named as a former communist before the committee. And so the Stanley and Carl, you're right, in the end, Stanley felt compelled to fire him. Carl felt betrayed by Stanley and his other business partners. He forgave all kinds of people for what happened during the blacklist, but he never could forgive Stanley, and the two guys never talk again after a very, very strong and creative partnership.
Talk about Gary Cooper and his role, because he did try to come to Forman's defense.
Yes, he did. I mean, Cooper is a conservative Republican and an anti-communist, you know, and he's one of the founders of the Motion Picture Alliance, which was a right-wing group led by John Wayne in 51 that was all about weeding these communists out. But Cooper also was very intuitive. He was 50 years old. He was having trouble getting good movies to make because the studio system was beginning to collapse, and Cooper couldn't write and direct his own movies. So he loved working with these young guys, and he loved Carl Foreman's script. And as they started to shoot the film, he and Carl had a very good artistic partnership, and he liked him and he trusted him. So when Carl told him, hey, I've been subpoenaed, I'm going to have to appear before this committee, I'm not in the party anymore, but I don't know what's going to happen here, Cooper said, well, how can I help? I trust you. I like you. I knew you guys were liberals, you know, but, you know, you're good guys. So he even offered to go and appear before the committee himself to defend Carl. That wasn't going to work, but he tried. And when Carl did get blacklisted and tried to form his own little independent production company, Cooper at first went along with that, wanted to invest in it. But the pressure was too great. From his friends, from gossip columnists like Hedda Hopper, even from John Wayne, who was head of the Alliance at that time and who also put pressure on Cooper, and he had to back down.
John Wayne said that he would never regret having helped run Foreman out of the country.
Yes, he did. Wayne was more ideological than Cooper. He believed in good guys and bad guys. He tried, you know, after Carl refused to testify, Wayne met with him and he pleaded with him to go back to the committee and to answer the questions because, you know, he thought Foreman was a smart guy. And so Wayne is an interesting figure too. But in the end, he was much more hard line. And he did help run him out of the country by, you know, helping kill the new film deal that the company that Foreman wanted to form and forcing him to leave the country. But sure enough, many, many, many years later, Foreman's remarried. He's lived in London 25 years. He finally gets back to Hollywood and he runs into Wayne at a restaurant. He's got his two little English children with him with the cute little accents, and he introduces them and they have a nice handshake. He could forgive John Wayne. He could never forgive Stanley Kramer.
That idea, that image, that iconic image of Gary Cooper walking down this deserted street and facing that showdown with four armed killers. Obviously, we look at that as a great dramatic moment in Hollywood and on the screen, but also the great meaning that it had then and that it has now.
Well, I think it helps to know the context when you're watching a film like that. It just enriches it a bit. But I have to say, I mean, you know, you can sit down and watch High Noon right now and just watch it for the sheer pleasure of it. Presidents loved High Noon, for example, and not just, you know, folks on the left. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower loved it when it came out and cheered for the lawman. Bill Clinton screened it something like 20 times. I think presidents, you know, the White House is kind of a lonely job, and they feel sometimes that when the tough decisions come, they're on their own. Their friends might peel off a bit. So something about High Noon, I think, works for all of us of whatever politics we practice or believe in, because it's an American story, and it's a fundamental story about what is courage. I should say the other reason I loved Carl Foreman as a character is because I don't think he was trying to be a hero. He certainly didn't want to be a martyr. He didn't want to lose the beautiful, successful career he was building, but testifying and naming names was a bridge too far for him, just like for the lawman, who doesn't really want to be a hero either, who just as soon get out of town, but he can't abandon the town. He feels he has to stand up to these guys. So, and that's a real lesson on what courage amounts to, something you got to do because you don't have any choice. For these two men, certainly that's what it was.
And for Foreman, ultimately, while not what he wanted and what he had carved out for the beginning of his career, it does end up not as a tragic story as so many of these stories from that time turned out to be.
That's true. A number of people, you know, never worked again. Their health was broken. People died, you know, young, and families got broken up. A lot of, Larry Parks, the actor who testified early on and even named a few names, but did it reluctantly. He'd been nominated for Academy Award for Best Actor, but after this, he did Dinner Theater for the rest of his life. It was a blow. It was a blow to Carl, too. He had writer's block for a while. He was angry. You know, his family life fell apart. He divorced his first wife, or she divorced him. You know, so there were scars and deep wounds. But you're right. Carl was one of the lucky ones. The damage to hundreds and hundreds of people was immense and so unnecessary, in my view. I mean, even the ones who'd been in the Communist Party, they weren't trading espionage. They weren't doing espionage. They weren't out to overthrow the government. They were political dissidents. And for them to be hounded in this way and purged, you know, suggests that sometimes our democracy can be pretty fragile.
Well, the name of the book is High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. The book is published by Bloomsbury. Glenn Frankel, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, it's my pleasure, Joe. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
If you're smart, you will get out too.
I can't.
I know.